Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. How to wing it and influence people. Hit it! Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. How you doing today? Well, we're back with another episode. Ready to rumble your eardrums. Hi-yo! What have I been up to? It's been another week, and that means that I've been doing stuff. Where has it? First things up, I have, as of this recording, finished the book one of Masks of Narlahotep. And I've got a bunch of calls talking about masks today, and so we'll definitely get into that. The other thing was Carl from the GMologist Presents sent me a link to a YouTube channel called XP Lovecat, and this is a woman who basically ran the entirety of the 7th edition version of Masks of Narlahotep and gives advice on running the entire campaign. So I put that into the show notes so you guys can find it. But man, it is comprehensive. She has a video for each chapter, what she thought was good about it, what she thought was bad about it, things that she suggests that you should do. And I listened to the whole thing. It's fabulous. And not only that, but she has like tons of videos on a lot of other stuff. Just looking at her YouTube channel, I can see she's got basic tips on how to run your games. She's got stuff on Vaesen. She's got stuff on Call of Cthulhu. She's got stuff on Cult, Fudge, Cyberpunk. Overall, looks like an excellent YouTube channel that you should definitely be checking out. So thank you very much, Carl, for hooking me up with that. Friday night, I played Magic as usual, did my little Commander game that I enjoy. I don't know how many of you guys follow Magic, but I have just been feeling completely overwhelmed with the amount of sets that they've been putting out. It feels like they come out like every 3 months now, and I just, financially, it's just difficult to keep up. But like, game-wise, the number of mechanics, the number of new cards, it's just unbelievable. And the power creep just seems to be going up. This new set, Dragonstorm, Tarkir Dragonstorm, just seems like a super powerful set. And, you know, it just feels discouraging because I'm kind of like, I don't want to pay to play, you know? And at the same time, like, I don't necessarily feel like the people in my game group are necessarily doing it to pay to win kind of, you know, idea. But at the same time, it's like, you know, what are you going to do? Tell them, like, stop buying cards? You know, like, they have every right to buy cards. They want to play them. If they've got the extra income to do it, then go for it. I don't know. I think I might start to take a back seat on that. I'm not 100% sure. And especially with the way things are going in terms of prices, everything is going up these days. So, yeah. I got a bunch of calls this week. We shall plunge into the Mimic Mailbox. Oh yeah, you like that, huh? That's the sound of a mimic. If I have ever heard a sound of a mimic, that is definitely a mimic mailbox. Okay, all right, here we got a first time caller, and let's hear what he has to say.
Good evening, Jason. I must say I'm new to the D&D podcast and really love the experience so far. I have a question you might help me with as a real-life dungeon master. Just before getting to it, let me explain a little bit what kind of experience I have with the role-playing game. I was once a heavy roller when building characters and always looking for a best weapon, optimization, etc. Until I made my first and only character, I've invested a lot of time in lore, background, and applied that in all of the action in-game. And after a couple sessions, and moved outside of the region where I used to play, I felt like I've played my best ever character, and every new one that I will ever make won't stand a chance against. So to get back to the question, what an experience a dungeon master could say to a player who set aside his dice for multiple years ago, fearing he couldn't beat his past game to get back into role-playing. So thank you. Keep on good work, and I'll wait your answer. Thank you.
First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it, and it's a really good call. Really good question. I would say the first thing that I would do is I would go and I would look up Roleplay Rescue, the podcast Roleplay Rescue by my good friend Che Webster. He is all about talking about how we can get back into the role-playing hobby after being out of it for a long time. So that would be my first recommendation. Secondly, it sounds like you've had an evolution in your journey, right? You went from having an optimized character to like adding lore and background, you know, stuff to it to give it a real personality. And I think that's great. And I wouldn't let that stop you, having that great character stop you from getting into another game and thinking like, oh, the new character I have will never compare to the old one that I had. I think, sometimes we have characters that end up being important to us for the rest of our lives. And then there's other times that we're going to have characters that are just going to be, you know, a forgotten footnote. What I think is important is that you just, you know, go with the flow and see what happens. And, you know, who knows, maybe your next game, you'll find that character. In a more practical terms, I know that there are, in terms of like getting into gaming again after being on a hiatus for so long, there are many websites and Facebook groups, especially in our region, that are always recruiting people to join. And you can play in game stores, which is probably where I would start if I was getting back into the game again. In fact, that's kind of what I ended up doing. That's how I ended up getting back into the game. Essentially, the store that I play Magic at was somebody was asking on the Facebook page if they could get somebody to teach them how to play D&D, and I answered the call, and that was how my new game group, the one that I play with currently, was started. I still have one member from that group that's of the original, but it's just continued to grow from there. And the nice thing about playing in public is that, you know, you're not opening yourself up to, or your home up to, like strangers. You can kind of feel out people first, and then once you feel comfortable, you can move into, you know, running games at your own house or at their houses. So that would be my suggestion. But thank you very much for your call. Really appreciate it. And take care, man. Next up, we have a call from Riley on safety tools. So let's hear what Riley has to say.
Hey, Jason. Riley here. Really enjoyed your latest episode, and listening to some of the call-ins made me think I should call in on safety tools quickly as well. I really enjoyed Barry's point about its usefulness in online play. I'm playing online almost exclusively these days, and I use them, but I never really thought about the advantages of those in that setting. Obviously, I can't see my players. I'm not picking up all these social cues. We don't play with webcams, which I think is probably a mistake that I'll look to rectify at some point. But so I use them, and this is how I implement them. So in session one, before we start playing, I go over genre and tone expectations, and I bring up a couple of lines and veils. I don't use that terminology, but I just say, you know, if things like this come up, I'm going to be skipping over them. And that's, as an example, violence against children, right? And then, you know, I say if there's anything else, let me know, either privately or now. And then I use the X card. Again, I don't phrase it like that. I just say, if we need to stop the game for any reason, just say pause and we'll pause. And I say that can be because you're feeling uncomfortable. You just got a phone call that you really need to answer and you're involved in the current scene, or you're completely confused as to what's going on, right? For whatever reason, we need to stop and make some changes or ask some questions and get before we continue. Just say pause and we'll pause. Of course, online play has some advantages as well because people can just message me privately and I'll be able to see that, right? If they're not comfortable with the group, and you know, I'm playing with friends, so hopefully they are comfortable. But sometimes you're playing with complete strangers and you're not going to, so that's fair as well. So yeah, that's my take on it. I think I don't see too much value in anything more beyond that personally. Of course, if I joined a game that had other tools, that wouldn't be an issue for me either. Now, of course, there is the whole thing of, oh, well, I don't want this in my game, I don't want that in my game, and you've joined a game that's about that. I think it's okay if to say, okay, well, this isn't the game for you, right? You know, if you're going to play Vampire, The Masquerade, and there's some challenging themes in that, and if you're not okay with them, you shouldn't be playing Vampire, right? Especially if they're the themes that you want to explore. Without being creepy, because obviously you can do that as well, like, you know, exploring them in a fun way or interesting way. But yeah, that's that. Really enjoyed your hearing about Dolmenwood. Keep that up. I found Holland Oak is a really fun dungeon to play. In my experience, it's a little bit deadly for first levels. I don't know if that translates exactly to Shadow Dark. I've played it, but maybe it's a little bit less deadly in that system. But I feel like you'd benefit from getting to level 2, getting a little bit of hit points, some extra spells, and of course Shadow Dark, you've probably got those extra spells, and maybe a magic item or two can help. But it sounds like your players are tackling it very well, so that's good. Yeah, anyway, keep it up. Bye for now.
Hey Riley, thank you so much for the call, and I think you hit on a bunch of really good points. First of all, when you're playing online, I don't even know how you can do that without having the people on video. That would drive me absolutely nuts. I mean, I guess if that's what your group is down with, then that's what you do, right? But for me, you know, having that video to be able to at least see people's faces is super important. And I was listening to a podcast that was talking about even hand signals, like we don't trust people if we can't see their hands, and so that's one of the big issues when it comes to basically, you know, playing on video. Yeah, I also agree with you when it comes to session one. I definitely do the same thing. You know, I basically say, okay, this is the stuff that we're, you know, that I'm going to talk about. That's cool. This is the stuff that I'm not going to talk about, or I don't want to talk about, period. And, you know, if something comes up, you know, let me know. And I think, yeah, you do. That is definitely an advantage to playing online, is that you can have somebody send you a message and, you know, there's less risk of feeling called out, like, oh, what are you, like some kind of a wussy because you don't like that, and then getting made fun of for it. And I think that's something that a game master's got to lay down, like, hey, I'm not going to tolerate that kind of behavior at my table. You know, everybody should feel, I think that's something I emphasize emphatically, is that, you know, everybody in this room should feel safe and should be feel comfortable being who they are and expressing themselves. And, you know, there's no place to belittle people beyond like the friendly ribbing and stuff like that. But, you know, every group is a little bit differently. And I know that out of the three groups I have, there's different things that I can say and do with each one of them. Each group has their own sort of things that they appreciate and things that they definitely wouldn't appreciate. You know, specifically like when I run Deadlands or when I run Call of Cthulhu, like one of the things that for me, it's like, listen, I know maybe historically racism and, you know, misogyny to women and all that kind of stuff was tolerated, but that's definitely not something that I'm going to tolerate at my tables. And I don't even want to deal with that, you know? So if it's not historically accurate, then, you know, I don't feel like that's a loss in my games. There's some things I don't think are worthwhile representing in the game. You know, we're here to have fun, not necessarily, you know, accurately historically recreate certain things. And I also agree when you're talking about like certain games not being for everyone. You know, for example, Cult is one of those games that I really want to play, but I know that it has some very serious themes and horror involved in it. And I think I would have to be very careful about the group that I chose to play that game with. So yeah, good point there. I think it's okay. Like, hey man, not everything is meant for everybody. So that's cool. And as far as Dolmenwood goes, I'm still, man, I really want to get the complete set, but I'm just, ugh, the money. As far as the Hole in the Yoke, its deadliness, and how it relates to Shadow Dark. So I basically did a conversion, you know, on the fly. It's pretty relatively simple. And as far as it being dangerous, so like I've boosted hit points in my game right from the beginning. And also the players have a bunch of magic items that they've already gotten. And then, of course, spells. They have access to casting, like repeated. It's like roll to cast. It's not a fire and forget fancy and magic. And also, I give them Deathbringer dice, which is something Professor Dungeon Master talks about, and that also reduces the deadliness. So, because I'm not a killer DM, it's not in my blood, and, you know, I'm more about running a fun game than trying to, like, beat the living tar out of my players. So, thank you so much for the call, Riley. Glad that you're enjoying the show. Let's move on to the next caller. We got Joe. And Joe's got a bunch of different things to say, and let's hear what they are.
Yo, what up, Jason? So now that Barry has given his seal of approval, I felt it was appropriate for me to call in. Anyway, man, just listening to your latest two episodes, which I think are episodes 7 and 6. And I'm listening to 6 where you're giving your... I will try not to swear on your show because I know that's what you're going for, where you're giving your sort of RPG horror stories, right? And one, I want to say for that first one where you got mad because your fellow player yelled at you and the Dungeon Master was laughing, that sucks, and that sounds like you had every right to get mad. I would add that maybe the Dungeon Master wasn't laughing at you, just at the... situation, because from an outside perspective, that's funny. I've had players do crazy stuff that ended up in their character's death in like wild way. I had a guy fail an acrobatics check, fell off a log and drowned in like a 1 foot deep creek because he only had like 2 hit points left. He was running away from a bunch of orcs. He tried to run across a log, failed the acrobatics check, fell in the water, went to 0 hit points and died. And I laughed. It was just a crazy experience. I wasn't laughing at him. I was just laughing, cause it was funny, man. But the fact that you're self-aware now and you recognize those things in yourself is huge, man. That's a huge step. There are so many people in the world who would take those situations that you described, those first two, and I'll get to the third one in a second, but those first two situations you described and say it was completely the other person's fault. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm perfect. They suck. But the fact that you recognize that in yourself is awesome, man. That speaks so highly of you. So congratulations on that. As far as the third story goes about the, you know, invading the Loth temple and killing the newborn babies and stuff and the safety tools and stuff. Yeah, I don't know if you know, but I'm running Wrath of the Righteous for Pathfinder, and we're getting through up to the 6th book. So I've been reading through the 6th book, and slight spoilers for a monster in the 6th book of Wrath of the Righteous, but there's a monster. I won't even give the spoiler. There's a monster in there that I had a distinct inkling would upset one of my players deeply, because I know my players really, really well. We talk all the time. And especially this particular player, I know her very, very, very well. And I had a feeling this character, this monster would be bad news. So I called her up and I said, hey, I want to talk to you about something, and it might be upsetting. And she said, she took a breath and said, okay, I'm ready. What do you got? And so I said, okay, there's this monster that this is what they're like. and I think that's not going to be good for you. And she took another breath and said, yes, that I wouldn't want that in the game. Thank you for talking to me about it. Thank you for telling me. Thank you for telling me in the way that you told me. And so it's a super easy fix, right? Like, now I just go to that monster and I just totally reskin him. I don't have to change any stats or anything. Just reskin the monster. No problem whatsoever. Super easy peasy. They won't even notice when it happens. And so, like you were saying, communication is key. And knowing your player, it's hard these days because a lot of people are playing with folks they don't know, you know, or you don't talk to very often. So it's a little tougher. So that's when safety tools do come into effect. But, like, you know, if you're playing with someone all the time and you talk to them all the time and you care about them, yeah, man, communication is just key. So awesome, awesome stuff, Jason. Congratulations on podcasting. Like BJ said, welcome to the Anchor Sphere, man. We are happy to have you. Yeah, that's it, man. Oh, last thing before I go. Massive Nyarlathotep, however you say that. Crazy timing on your episode because Runeslinger, who's in the Audio Dungeon Discord, he just put out a video talking about this other YouTube channel. I think they're called Armchair Arcane Keepers or something like that. Anyway, go watch the latest Casting Shadows video on the Runeslinger channel. He talks about his experiences with running masks several different times and what he's done to sort of make it flow really well. And then he gives a shout out to this other channel where it's these two dudes and they're both running masks at the same time for different groups. And they're talking about how different groups approach different aspects of the game. So that could be super, super, super helpful for you if you are going to run it, because that is also one of my bucket list games that I want to run. I want to get the full H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society box of clues and props that they've made for masks, the deluxe edition. It's amazing. If you've never looked at that, it's absolutely gorgeous. Comes with like full newspapers about the adventure. It's awesome, man. Anyway, dude, take it easy. Congratulations. Keep on doing what you're doing and peace out.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's talk about a few things. You covered so many things here and I think they're all really great and worth talking about. First of all, the GM laughing at me during that session. Yeah, you know what? In retrospect, after I recorded and I was thinking about it and I was like, you know, he probably was just laughing at the situation and my recollection of the situation made it feel as if he had been laughing at me that whole time. And yeah, I agree. I think, you know, especially now that I have the maturity to sort of, you know, recognize situations like that and not feel like I'm being attacked, I would do the same thing, you know, and I would be able to, but I think I'd also be able to laugh at the situation too of going, wow, that was absolutely ridiculous. I can't believe that that actually happened. But I do appreciate the congratulations on being self-aware. I think it's a challenge, right? Everybody, we grow at different times. We learn things at different times. I just didn't want to be, I got tired of blaming other people for the world around me. I was a very angry kid, very angry young man. And, you know, at some point in my life, I decided, hey, you know what? I got to start taking accountability and taking responsibility for things in my life. And, you know, there's only so much that I can control. And, you know, how I react to things is one of those things, right? You know, safety tools, that's another thing where I'm really surprised on some level about, because when I started talking about safety tools, I thought I was going to get a lot of pushback from people going, oh, safety tools, like, okay, they're, you know, millennial. Oh, I need a safe space. You know, I think it's just a part of maturing, right? And kind of realizing that, hey, we don't need to be rough with each other. That, you know, we can have, taking consideration for other people is an important thing. And especially in a game and in an environment that's as social as this one, right? It really is a team sport. And, you know, respecting everybody around the table is a big part of that. And I especially agree, you know, I think there is a big distinction between playing with a group of people that you know versus a group of people that you don't know. So whether you're playing online with people that you've just met, or you're going to conventions, or you're just starting out with a new group, those are the real tricky situations where like anything could kind of happen. And so, yeah, I think that's where the real value of safety tools can come into play. But I think, again, it doesn't have to be one of those things that has to be super complex, right? And I love your story about the person in your group and how you handled that situation. I think, you know, that's exactly the kind of, you know, responsibility that we have as game masters, just to sort of recognize, you know, like, hey, is this, you know, this might cause an issue at my table. And that could be anything, not just something that's like upsetting in terms of, you know, like emotionally, but also in terms of like, hey, I don't think that my players would appreciate this being a fight all the time, or other sort of like experiences that we have at the table. And finally, dude, I just wanted to say, you know, your Wrath of the Righteous game, to me, that was one of the big things that moved me to kind of like being like, listen, I have these certain modules and certain books and campaigns that I really, really want to play. And, you know, I need to take the initiative and get them to the table and make it happen, because just hoping that it's going to happen, you know, is sort of a recipe for disaster and making sure that it never happens. And, you know, I commend you, man, because I think what your game has been going on for like 2 years now, 2.5 years, I'm not sure. But yeah, dude, I mean, the fortitude that it takes to keep a game going for that long is that's nothing to laugh at. And so I commend you, and you've been definitely been an inspiration to me in, you know, trying to get masks to the table. And I was unaware that Runeslinger had a video on Masks Nyarlathotep. I did see his video for the unboxing of the HP Lovecraft Society props, which, I have had my finger on the trigger, so to speak, about getting that game, getting that prop set for so long. And I'm just like, I'm so worried. I'm like, it's, they look so beautiful, but then I'm like, oh, what if the game crashes and burns, you know, and now I've spent another like $200 on something that's not going to get used. And hey, if any of you guys have a way that I can explain to my wife why I need to get this prop set, you let me know, send me an email, send me a voicemail, you know, I will try to convince her that this is something that's absolutely necessary for me to get. Also, talking about, you mentioned the Armchair Keepers of Arcane Secrets YouTube channel. So it's interesting that Runeslinger brings that up. He probably listens to the same stuff that I did, or maybe he found it on his own. But I found out about them through the Modern Mythos podcast, which has John Hook and Seth Skorkowski. That's a great podcast for if you want to do horror gaming. They talk about Call of Cthulhu and Delta Green and all of that kind of stuff. And so I highly recommend it. And so I haven't been up to date on the Armchair Keepers, but yeah, very, very cool. Interesting kind of concept that they're doing, having the two guys running, you know, masks for, you know, their own groups and then comparing notes between each other about what happened during their sessions and whatnot. So yes, thank you so much for passing it on. And all right, so we got another call from Joe. So let's hear what he has to say in this call.
Yo, Jason, me again, working my way through episode number 5 on my lunch break. And I want to call in. You're talking about whether or not it's all that important to read the adventure before you run it. And I just want to chime in and say, I feel it is really important to read the adventure in its entirety before running it. And I want to give an example of why I think that's important. So this was many, many years ago. I was a player in a Wrath of the Righteous campaign, And the Dungeon Master was awesome, man. He was kicking ass. He was running, ran through the first book and a half. It was so much fun, so rich. The NPCs were awesome. It kicked butt, right? He was doing an amazing job. And then something happened with his work, and I think his schedule got changed. And for some reason, he said that he couldn't prep anymore. And that's a whole different discussion. I'm not going to get into that right now. But so he couldn't prep anymore. And now he started reading the adventure the day of, and oftentimes at the actual table while we were trying to play. And it became unplayable. We couldn't play anymore. It went from an amazing campaign to just a terribly run game. Like, he'd be reading paragraphs ahead at the table and then be like, oh, wait, this thing actually happened back here. And it was clear he hadn't read it. It was clear he didn't know what was going on. And it was a big, big bummer, man. So that's my two cents on why I think it's important to read the whole adventure. Anyway, dude, short one for me. Take it easy. Peace out.
Hey, Joe. I take it as a good sign when people tell me that they're listening to the back catalog. To me, it makes it feel like, okay, well, I'm doing a good job here. If you're curious enough to go back and listen to my older episodes, then clearly, you know, I'm doing something right. So thank you so much for going back and listening. And thanks especially for calling in. You know, I agree. You're 100% right. I think my biggest point in that particular episode was to just start playing, like to not hold back from playing because you feel like you haven't read enough. But you're right, 100%. I think your example with Wrath of the Righteous is a very good one. Part of what I was saying is that you need, I'm not saying that you have to not read. You definitely need to read. For running Masks of Narlahotep, I'm definitely going to be reading, or I have read one whole book so far, and I intend to read the whole thing before I go in it. My point also was that, so you can fill in sections, right? You can have little side quests or do little things to sort of give yourself time to prep. But in an adventure path, that's pretty difficult. The adventure paths, at least the ones that I've seen, tend to not give you a lot of opportunity to sort of stopgap, if you wish. You know, you kind of, one thing leads to the next. They're, you know, in a lot of ways, they're a railroad, and it's sort of expected that, you know, one step is going to follow the next in a logical sort of order. Obviously, not every adventure path is like that, but generally speaking, they're trying to tell a story, right? Yeah, I agree. And yeah, I think that's a great topic about preparation. And, you know, maybe I'll talk about that later on, or I think I definitely will talk about that later on. But yeah, that sounds like a major bummer, dude. And you bring up a great point. That's all the calls we have today. I really appreciate the calls that we got from our first time caller and from Riley and from Joe from Hindsightless. Check out his podcast. I love listening to Hindsightless just because Joe is so full of energy and spunk. And I mean, you can't leave listening to his podcast without feeling a little bit better about yourself during the day. Keep up the good work, guys. Thank you so much for your phone calls. Let's get into the main topic, which is how to wing it and influence people.
Let's get it on.
How to wing it and influence people. Jason, why do you always need to be so arcane? Why do you need to wrap everything in such mystery and strangeness? Esoterica, if you will. I mean, I guess that's just the kind of guy I am. But what is this topic? How about I preface it with a little story? Early on, I was still a young man. This was probably sometime in the early 2000s. And I never went to university, but one of my friends did. And he was running a game, and so he was like, hey guys, why don't you come to the university? I got a space here, and we can game. It'll be super convenient for me. We all agreed. This is Concordia University. It was off of the campus off of Sherbrooke, which is, it's a beautiful campus if you've ever been. The cool thing about where we were is that it was in this area where they had part of the music department. And so there were these like corridors, And in those corridors were these little booths that musicians from the music program would go into and basically soundproof so they could play their instruments. It was pretty cool, and it was a fun time. I really enjoyed going and playing there. One day we're all sitting down at the table. Game Master's pulling out his books, got his notebook. One of the first things he does, as we're all like getting our character sheets out, and he pulls out the third edition Monster Manual, and he starts flipping through the pages, and he's like, okay, well, I found a monster, and so I'm ready to do tonight's session. And I was like, are you for freaking real, my dude? Like, that's your session planning? Like, you just open up the Monster Manual and pick a monster, and then that's it, we're just gonna do it? That was pretty crushing. It just felt like, why? What am I doing here? If this guy didn't take the time to plan out his session and stuff like that. And in some respects, I mean, you gotta commend the guy for being able to run a session with just a entry for the Monster Manual. But I always felt like you needed to spend a lot more time prepping your game than just immediately sitting across from your players, picking the monster out, and then rolling. This guy was an experienced game master. I mean, this wasn't the first game he'd ever run. He'd run many games. In fact, Cyberpunk 2020 was probably the game that he was best known for, and while I only got to play a couple of Cyberpunk 2020 games with him, people genuinely loved the game that he ran. So I found this all a little surprising. Ultimately, what this is about, that ultimate and perhaps an advanced skill that you need to have as game master, and that is called winging it, improv, maybe you could think of another term. Let me read a little quote here from Dungeon Magazine, issue 128. It's an article written by Monty Cook from Dungeoncraft called Winging It. I quote, "Some people believe that a key to good DMing is winging it, which I agree with. However, some take the idea too far. In fact, these DMs contend that a good DM doesn't prepare, he just makes it up as he goes along." Further down, he continues on, quote, "The worst part of this belief is that it implies that people who prepare are somehow lesser DMs. If you don't know who Monty Cook is, he is a prolific game designer. He's one of my favorites. He was one of the designers for 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons. He worked at Wizards of the Coast, and then later on he started his own company called Malhavik Press, where he published his Tolis books, and he also published his Arcana Evolved game and a host of other like very cool books during the 3rd edition era of the game. Later on, he would come back to Wizards of the Coast to work on Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, but then shortly left to start his own game company again, this time called, aptly enough, Monty Cook Games, where he created the Cypher system. And that is a very popular game line. I've played the Cypher system. It's very cool. So to say this guy knows what he's talking about, essentially, is an understatement. He's one of my idols, and I don't say that lightly, when it comes to running role-playing games, writing role-playing material. Like, he's just, in my eyes, he's the master. He is the one that I look up to. And if he says these things, then I'm extremely inclined to believe it. Later in the same article, he says, and I quote, "That said, even the best prepared DM can't plan for every contingency. There are times when every DM has to wing it." It took me a long time to understand this concept, because I always felt like, well, do you really need to wing it if you are running a pre-written scenario? I mean, everything's there, right? You know, the whole outline, the character, the NPCs, the enemies' plans, all of that stuff. But the fact is, regardless of whether you're running a published adventure or you're running a homebrew, everything created by yourself campaign, improv is a vital skill to learn. One of the other things he says here in the same article, he goes on to say,
And I quote, "You have to make the players believe that everything is fine and you are perfectly prepared." That feels like a pretty scary thing when you hear that. You gotta have everything prepared, or make it seem like everything's perfectly prepared. I would argue that I don't think that your players actually expect you to believe that you're 100% prepared. I think that in general, your players are willing to cut you some slack and be understanding that, hey, you know, this is a game, you did your best, and, you know, obviously you're not going to have all the answers to everything. What does Monty suggest that we do? Further in the article, he basically says the very first thing, don't panic. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, rule number one. If you haven't read the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, by the way, you should be doing yourself a favor, because that is a fabulous book. I've read it multiple times, and there is a little book that the main character has, and it has a thing on the very front of it that says, don't panic. In fact, I had a guy in my high school who had a calculator, and on the front of his calculator, he had that written, don't panic. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Once I read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it all became clear. That's step one, don't panic. Then he says something, and this is another thing that I completely... First of all, panicking just causes you to lose your mind. And then everything that you knew goes out the door. So it's important to keep yourself together. Secondly, he says you should use the time in between to plan. What does that mean? So while you're sitting at the table, your players are doing all sorts of stuff. They're talking to each other. They're going to the bathroom. You know, they're looking up rules, maybe looking up their spells, you know, talking shop about whatever. And so there are these little times where they're discussing plans, maybe in between themselves, about what to do next or how we should handle this certain scenario. And this gives you there are many of these times that appear where you just sit back and let them do what they're doing, and you can collect yourself and you can make a few notes to yourself, maybe look up a few things to like get yourself kind of in the right headspace. Essentially, figure out what your next move is going to be. Interestingly, one of the other things that Monty says in the article is that there is no rule in the book that says the DM has to be honest with the players. Now, what I think he means by that is that obviously you should be honest with your players in terms of like the rules and, you know, those sorts of things. But when it comes to your preparedness at the game, you don't need to tell the players anything. You don't need to tell them like, oh, guys, I'm not ready for this. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, you just go with the flow. Try to give off this sense that like, yeah, man, that's cool. You guys want to do that? That's cool. No problem. He essentially says there are like two scenarios in which you sort of need to be prepared to improvise. The first one is PCs or the player characters doing what you expected, but not the way you expected them to do it. The second is for the players to go off in a direction that you weren't expecting. I've experienced both of these things. In fact, if there's anything that I could say, it's that no plan survives contact with the enemy. And by the enemy, I mean the players. One of the things that Monty suggests is that when the players do something that's expected, but not the way you expected, that the best thing that you can do is to go into yes mode and go with the flow. And what he means by that is that it's very easy. It's almost a reflex for us as game masters to basically shut down the players and what they want to do and say no. And, you know, I'm not prepared for that or whatever. Not to say that you can't, but generally speaking, if you do those things, if you say yes, and if you go with the flow, you're going to find that things just tend to work out better. The second thing is that the PCs go off in a direction that you weren't expecting, meaning that, you know, this wasn't the adventure that you had planned. And what he suggests in this case is that if the players throw you a curveball, that you should throw a curveball back at them, which I thought was very interesting. And essentially what he's saying is that there's things that you could do where you can put something in front of them to sort of buy yourself some time, you know, come up with the next leg of what they're going to do. So for instance, saying they want to go and do this thing that you weren't expecting, you could have an NPC who they owe a favor to show up at that moment and sort of, you know, say, hey, guys, you know, remember when you said that you'd do whatever you needed to do to help me out down the line? Well, like, I'm calling in that favor now. Or the other thing you could do is have an old enemy appear that sort of, like, you know, stops them from kind of doing what they want to do. And he suggests that you should do this with care and, you know, not, it shouldn't be your constant go-to of, like, blocking the players. And I would agree with that. I tend to feel like blocking players tends to create a certain kind of resentment. And while that the players will be cool with letting that go, they really want you, they really would prefer to be able to move forward with their agenda. That's why he says that sometimes, you know, when that curveball comes at you, you just need to take the swing and, you know, swing at that curveball and let the events play out regardless. So don't stop them, just roll with it is basically what he's saying. And he's saying that, quote, there are three things that you can do. Think about where events in the campaign have been, where are they now, and where are they probably going to go, and pull out three things. Consider them the building blocks of your new adventure. That was part one. In part two, in issue 129 of Dungeon Magazine, he has this part two of the article. It was a three-part article, but I'm only really focusing on the first two books, first two magazines articles. He says there's a few things that you can do to prepare to be unprepared. First of all, he suggests lists of names, character traits, treasures, or interesting places, because these are all things that are not easy to come up with on the fly, especially names. Whenever I play, especially in my Stars Without Numbers game, but I always have a list of characters that I keep, and whenever I need a name, I can roll on a table at random, or I can just pick one, I write it down in my notebook, and then I cross that off the list so I don't use it again. Another thing that he talks about is that sometimes you need to have, you know, like a location, or as he calls it, a destination, to, you know, give your players something to do. And he says, quote, since you're reading Dungeon Magazine, it's safe to say that you're not one of those DMs that avoids pre-published adventures like the plague, suggesting that only uncreative people use them. And honestly, this is another thing that I really appreciate, is that somehow there are these, and maybe they're old-fashioned now, but I just always got the sense that there's these people who are like, oh, I'm so creative. I don't use published material. And it's kind of like, dude, that's cool, man. Like, you don't need to use the published material, but, you know, you don't need to trash people that do. You know, I don't think that there's anything wrong. I think there's a lot of, you know, pros to using the published material. But, you know, that's a different topic for a different time. Basically, what he's saying is that it's good to have, like, a couple of things, like a dungeon. You know, you got a map. You know, maybe it's filled out with, you know, monsters and stuff already, but just having, like, locations in your little, like, binder that you can pull out and go, okay, this is a map of this, or, you know, here's like a little base of operations for your bad guys. He kind of suggests, but doesn't really say, it's more of like something that I discovered as from solo gaming, is that the use of spark tables or cards. So for instance, the Mythic Game emulator cards, or the cards from the Deck of Many Signs from Pickpocket Press's Tales of Argosa, you know, they have little words and stuff on them that you can use to sort of like create kind of ideas and concepts in your mind. And same thing with like oracles. So like rolling to see, okay, this has got a 50% chance, this is an 80% chance, 20% chance, just to give you an idea of like, hey, is there a gun in this room? Okay, let me roll my dice. You know what? There's probably a good chance there's a gun in here, a 75% chance. Roll. Oh, look, it's less than 75 on the dice. I guess there's a gun in this room. Say it's like, well, why would there even be a gun in this room? You can say, okay, well, there's a 25% chance. Oh, look at that. Yeah, I was right. Or, oh, wow, that's weird. I wonder why there was a gun in here. But the book that sort of like inspired this episode, I mean, I wanted to talk about improv because I think it's such an important part of being a game master. But I recently picked up this book called Play Unsafe by Graham Walmsley. And I put a link of that in the show notes. And what I he's written a bunch of really cool books. It's very small, very fast to read. You know, you wouldn't be reading it for very long. And essentially, he was inspired to write this after taking an improv course. And it's something that I've always wanted to do as a game master, because I feel like that's got to be super helpful to sort of have that tool in your belt, so to speak. So one of the things that he says is, he goes that he believes that we take the game too seriously and that we work too hard, try to make the game good. He also includes players in this. He says that players should stop trying to plan out their character arcs and just go with it. Essentially, he says that, and I quote, "If you're striving to scale the heights of awesome, we don't see awesome, we see you trying. Stop trying, aim to be average, and you'll enjoy yourself more." There was a few other things. So the thing that I like about that is that essentially what he was saying is that there's evidence to suggest that high performance athletes don't think about that they're doing something extraordinary. They just see themselves as just doing what they've been training to do. And so that essentially, you know, even though these guys are extreme athletes, the best in the world at what they do, they're not trying to be great. They're just doing. And so that's sort of what we should be doing as players, is that we should just be doing. Ultimately, isn't that the goal, is to just have fun and enjoy ourselves? I think this applies to both game masters and players, but it's like, do the obvious. So many times we get into these situations where it's like the players will back us into a corner as a game master, and we'll be like, oh my god, I don't know how to handle this. What am I supposed to do? And I think, again, don't panic. Take a step back. Think about it. And then the obvious answer is the thing that you should be doing. It doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need to be like some sort of mind-blowing thing. You just need to do the next step in the process, right? That will suggest itself. Another concept that he talks about is to build on each other's ideas. So this applies, I think, both to game masters and to players, is that, you know, if your players say something, then you should be trying to say yes. You should try to be adding onto those ideas. He says, and I quote, "Trust the other players. Trust they're good. Trust they like you. Trust that they are looking out for you." That applies to everybody at the table, right? We're, like I said, this is a very intimate sort of thing that we're doing. And so you need to have trust, and you need to be able to trust that the people are going to have your back and come up with something to make the game fun, and that they're not trying to sabotage it. In terms of, I think that's one of the things that I really like about this Play on Safe book, is that it really focuses both on player and game master. It doesn't just single out the game master. And I think that's key in the game, is that we're doing it together, and it's not just the game master's responsibility to like keep things rolling. And so another concept that he talks about is to reincorporate ideas from earlier in the session or campaign. And, you know, I think like that adds a certain verisimilitude to the game and keeps it interesting, and you know, those callbacks will make people go, wow, that was awesome. So the last two things before I wrap this up is that he says, take risks. So, quote, "Often we play carefully, afraid to fail. We sit quietly, afraid to take risks in case we play wrong." That to me is really profound, because this idea that we would be able to play wrong just seems so strange. And yet, if we consider it, I guarantee that we all do this. I think that every single one of us is worried about making a mistake or doing it wrong, playing wrong. And I don't know if that's really possible. I think that's something to take and to think about. And lastly, he says, play with energy. And I think that if everybody is putting their energy into the game, it's going to build up and everybody's going to have a good time. But if you have somebody at the table that's like, okay, you're like, yeah, dude, that's sucking the energy out, and nobody's going to have fun. So I think if everybody's enthusiastic and plays with energy to the best that they're able to, I think that the game will be better for it. And sometimes those weird ideas might not necessarily seem so weird given the circumstances. That's all I have to say today. I know it's a pretty long episode. I just wanted to ask you, the listeners, what advice do you have for a game master on improvising at the game table? Finally, I would like to thank everybody for listening. I would love to thank all my callers who called in. Mr. Anonymous, Riley, Joe Richter, thank you guys so much. Really appreciate it. Make sure you check out those dudes' podcasts. I put them in the show notes. Please rate, review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and slam a like and a comment onto YouTube. For some reason, my videos weren't loading onto YouTube, but I have rectified that now, so you'll be able to find them there. Music by Alexander Kizanaku. Cover art by John McNally. Pacific Northwest represent. You can call in and leave a message at my SpeakPipe, speakpipe.com/thedungeonplunger, or feel free to send an email, dungeonplunger, no the, just dungeonplunger, one word, @gmail.com. And remember, when you're plunging into the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt. Elbows up!